Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin News Show. I am your host, Vortex, and you guys are right here on the World Crypto Network YouTube channel, one of the best places to find news and information about cryptocurrency. Have an amazingly amazing panel for you guys ready here today. First, I just wanted to get a couple of announcements out of here. Just wanted to congratulate Charlie Lee for going full-time Litecoin. Ladies and gentlemen, he has quit his job at Coinbase and went full-time Litecoin, living the dream. Awesome, Charlie. Just wanted to give you a thumbs up for that. And then finally, Gabriel D. Vine, our very own Gabriel D. Vine. Just wanted to welcome him back to the World Crypto Network. Really glad to see him again on the Bitcoin group and doing his own interviews again. So everybody, definitely a follow Gabriel D. Vine. Really glad to have him back. So without further ado, I think we can go ahead and introduce the guests. Just wanted to get the topics out of the way today, guys. We're going to be talking about the user-activated soft fork. That's on everybody's mind, and I really wanted to create a discussion around that and get everybody's thoughts. We have some very important people here in the Bitcoin community, and I really wanted to get their thoughts on this. So first, let's introduce Mr. Eric Lombroso from Cyfrix. How you doing, Eric?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us and really loving your videos, your interviews, talking about the user-activated soft fork. I've seen you on a bunch of them, including even World Crypto Network, I think Mad Bitcoins. So just really, really, really happy to, really thankful for you for explaining everything to us. And we got Mr. Jameson Lopp from BitGo. How you doing, Jameson?
Doing well. I'm actually in the Valley this week, so it's nice to be visiting.
Awesome, awesome. The most manly Bitcoiner around, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jameson Lopp. And John Light joining us. Thank you so much, John, for joining us. Longtime Bitcoiner. How you doing, John?
If I can unmute. Thank you. Doing great. Doing great.
Yes, yes.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah, that Google Hangout mute is a little bit hard. You have to hover over it. It's retarded. But that's fine. So thanks so much, John. And listen, we got your article linked in the show notes for everybody to check out to prepare for the user-activated soft fork. John has a great blog post for what you can do to prepare, what the outcomes might be. It's just great. Everybody needs to check that out. So thanks, John, so much for writing that article. Really, really appreciate it. And finally, without further ado, the special guest for this show, we have Mr. Simon Dixon from Bank to the Future. Simon, how are you doing?
Really good. Thanks for having me. First time on the show. I'm normally in Hong Kong, but I'm in London this week. So I've got Big Ben in the background, and I'll be headed back to China next week. And we can discuss some of the things we're up to there as we go through the topics.
Awesome, awesome. Thanks so much, Simon, for joining us, man. I've seen you around, too, talking about all sorts of stuff about Bitcoin. You know, I really appreciate educating the community, though, of course, as you've said, now people are trying to be a little bit more excited about ICOs, but we've got to steer them back to Bitcoin. People have got to steer them back to the source, back to the main blockchain. So let's start out right away with our topics. Our first main topic, the user-activated soft fork. Guys, I really want to get your opinion on this. I have several questions here lined up that I'd like to go through everybody. But first, I just want to start out, we'll go with you, Simon, first, of course, the special guest. Just wanted to get your thoughts. What is your opinion on the user-activated soft fork? Do you think we need it? Is it better than SegWit 2x? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the main thing that this has done is that this scaling debate has been going on for so long. It feels like forever. And now we've got this date, 1st of August, where everyone can coordinate, everyone can figure out which side of the camp they're going to. The funny thing is that the situation that we're arisen with today is an unlimited number of different scenarios that could occur. But to be honest, I'm really excited. Bitcoin is at the highest price it's ever been. There's a lot of uncertainty in the market, but we've got a lot of new people coming to the market, a lot of institutions. And this August the 1st date is kind of like, I don't know what to draw it to, the analogy I want to give, but there's probably loads of things that we're involved with every day that we just don't know that there's these ginormous debates if you're really geeky and into it. I don't know, maybe, you know, the iPhone is debating whether to take one port off or something like that. And unless you're actually involved deep into it, you'll just completely ignore this stuff. And then suddenly the next iPhone comes out and there's another port on there that you didn't know about. I think that's what's happening with Bitcoin right now. To us, it seems like, you know, D-Day, the whole world is over. Bitcoin's about to go through this massive change. And yet the vast majority of people just holding their Bitcoins, have no idea, will make transactions on the day. And, you know, they just don't really have much understanding of it. But the fact that we've got this 1st of August date now is, I think, a massive progress. That we're going to have a result. I'm not sure exactly where it's going to go. I'm not sure what's going to happen next. My thoughts are that we're probably going to stay with the status quo, but hopefully SegWit gets in with some way. But, you know, I mean, I try to forecast what's happening next in Bitcoin, and boy, is it, you know, it throws surprises at you all the time. This market is such an exciting market. And there's always so much to learn. And so, you know, I'm excited to hear from the other panelists on, you know, some of the more technical ones about the game theory approaches right now. But, you know, I feel that this is a year we're gonna know where we're going next. And once we get past this scaling, the sky is the limit. It really is.
Absolutely. And it really is maddening, almost, the number of outcomes that could actually happen. It's when you really start thinking about all the game theory. You know, Jimmy Song was interviewed on Matt Bitcoins, and they were talking about just some of the ways. You know, Jimmy Song did a blog post about it, and it was just, you know, thousands of words long, super long, and it was only on three scenarios. So it's just a little crazy.
The most important thing to me, because I'm the guy that, you know, for the last couple of years, I've been speaking with lots of fund managers, hedge fund managers, all around the world, you know, people managing most of the money in the world. And my job for the last couple of years was to un-Blythe Masters or the institutions, because Blythe Masters had gone around all the institutions, every fund manager in the world, telling them about this amazing blockchain thing, private blockchain that, you know, and my job was to actually get them all into Bitcoin. And I was explaining how Bitcoin worked. And I, you know, pretty much all of them were going back, and they were buying large orders of Bitcoin by the end of it, because it was the only blockchain that actually did something from all the pitches they've heard. And so that was always my job. Now, if I had to go back to them and explain two Bitcoins, I think is a stretch too far. So I want to avoid two Bitcoins at all costs. You know, I've got, you know, next week in China, I've got a tour with Jim Rogers. We're doing 15 different cities in China. That's the guy that co-founded with George Soros a quantum fund. And I really, really don't want to have to explain two Bitcoins and hard forks and SegWit and 2 megabyte this. I just want to go, you know, kind of back to the basic talk, which is hard enough to understand, about why Bitcoin's a store of value and how it's going to change the world. And so I can't wait to get back there. Two Bitcoins is going to make life very difficult. So I just hope we get there. And I think by the end of this year, we'll have a clear path forward, a scalable blockchain. And that's exciting. That's really exciting.
Absolutely. And, you know, I myself can't wait to get back to tweeting just nothing but positive things about Bitcoin. Just like, you know, looking at the sky, everything's going to be fine kind of Bitcoin. No more of this UASF, no more of this forking, just how Bitcoin is going to change the world. And of course, as we know, Bitcoin is changing the world all over. We just had, I also linked this into the show notes, where Adam Meister's recent show this week in Bitcoin had some people from Venezuela on, and then how they were talking about it was just saving their lives, just literally saving their life. And when they were taking out different bills and denominization of their currencies, you know, these guys that had Bitcoin didn't care, right? They didn't care. It is a complete separation from their government. So just really awesome. I linked to that in the show. Everybody needs to check that out. So yeah, Bitcoin changing the world still. Can't wait to talk more about that. So let us go. Who did I have next? Well, no, I don't even remember. I think we're with Jameson next, actually. Jameson, what do you think about what we've spoken about so far? What do you think about this user-acted soft fork? Is this really needed? And, you know, what is your thoughts on what could happen? And tell us about what you think.
Well, you know, a lot of debates that happen the past few years with scalability tend to come down to, like, who has the power in the system. And we see a lot of people, especially they're pushing for hard fork to much larger block sizes, that are essentially making arguments that, well, the miners have the ultimate power. You know, they have the hash power. And I think this sort of hash power deference, if you will, or you know, looking to the Satoshi white paper and interpreting it as, you know, hash power and Nakamoto consensus, is kind of conflating different forms of consensus with your meat space consensus with your machine consensus, and I think that from a theoretical standpoint, the user-activated soft fork is correct. It is theoretically the most powerful weapon that the quote-unquote community has, because it is a system of self-sovereignty in that the users have the final say of what rules they're agreeing to. But when you really start to look at the reality of the situation, it becomes a lot more complicated of how do you actually roll out and deploy such a mechanism, especially when the different methods that are currently available to us seem to be somewhat contentious in and of itself. So I'm not completely convinced that like BIP 148, for example, has enough support behind it to really push us over the line. Of course, these things are always in flux. Anything can change. The August 1st deadline is quickly approaching, and as much as I wish I could say that, you know, the latest agreement with SegWit 2x would be able to find a quote-unquote compromise and get everybody together on the same path again, it is not really progressing as quickly or as amicably as I would hope that it would. So I'm not particularly confident that is going to result in something, you know, getting activated before the BIP 148 deadline. So right now, it's definitely uncertain. There seems to be more uncertainty than ever, and now we've got this additional time crunch that has been placed on us.
Yep, the time is ticking down. August 1st is coming, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. You know, first, real quick, Jameson, just wanted to congratulate you on your Max Kaiser appearance. I caught that as well. Explained things very well. It just amazing the technical details that you unleashed there in such short amount of time. So just thank you for that, for talking about Bitcoin. And yeah, you know, things can change overnight. I really much have been, I've been telling people this on Twitter and such and on my show for a while now. Things can change so fast. They can literally change overnight. Sentiment, global sentiment can change within 24 to 48 hour period, people, because Bitcoin, there's no borders. You know, this is global. This is 24/7. And so everybody's paying attention to the same things at the same time. And, you know, yeah, we have a lot of, you know, information asynchronous, you know, asynchronously and things like that. But it's still, everybody is watching those blocks get confirmed. Everybody is watching the price go up. So everybody is in this together. And, you know, so far, like you said, I understand you're not being too confident about SegWit 2x, because so far, according to the Wikipedia page that I also have linked on this show notes, not one single developer is okay with SegWit 2x. And it's kind of funny, even Matt Corello, like, even put an LOL instead of a no, a little bit of a troll on SegWit 2x. So yeah, it's very interesting to see. But let's go with Eric next. So Eric, you know, what do you think about the conversation so far? What do you think about user-activated soft fork? Are you worried that it's going to happen? Are you glad that it's here? And, you know, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I've been in the trenches for over 2 years now, just people throwing, you know, different forks, you know, different consensus changes that they've wanted to throw into the protocol. And, you know, when I first started working on Bitcoin, I realized that it was really hard to change consensus rules. That was just like a feature of the system. The soft forking mechanism that was created was a really creative way to be able to avoid a lot of the logistics issues of deployment, just because you don't have to have everyone upgrade at the same time, and you don't have really these chain split risks, as long as you know, hash power supports it. But now we have a situation where there's a divergence of interests, right? So as long as there's no conflict of interests and everyone works cooperatively, you know, miner activated soft forks are the safest way we know right now to be able to deploy a change to the network that is, you know, the most likely to have almost, you know, no chance of really like any significant glitches. There's been a couple in the past, like BIP 66, I think, had a couple, you know, issues, minor issues. But really, you know, if you look at the big scheme of things, like, it's really caused almost no disruption at all in the markets or in the, you know, commerce or anything like that. So I think that's the approach that we've sought. When the block size increase proposals were first put forth into the mailing list a couple of years ago, you know, it was clear. I mean, I think, you know, I was supportive of eventually finding a way to do that. But a lot of us were very concerned that was going to create divergent interests. There's, you know, different costs to different parts of the system, and I think that, you know, that kind of thing can externalize costs to other players. Unfortunately, the way that the protocol works right now, only miners are getting directly rewarded by running the protocol. So it really created a landscape where it was very likely that there'd be some kind of divergent interests. And then so when we worked on SegWit, the idea was to try to make it as little, you know, as uncontentious as possible, to kind of give everyone something that they wanted. So bigger blocks, fixed malleability, you know, fix the quadratic caching, you know, be able to add new script types so we could do like better crypto and stuff like that, you know. So all these different, and so we could compete with more like, you know, other smart contract platforms better. So like all these things that are, you know, getting rolled out in the thing like this, obviously it's a big update, but we did not anticipate that there'd be certain contentions anyways. A lot of issues that came out afterwards were things that we were not expecting. So as you can see, it's really, really, really hard. Even when you try to design a consensus change to be as uncontentious as possible, it's very hard to predict how different players in the ecosystem are going to take it and whether they're going to have some kind of divergent interest that you might not be aware of. There might be some issue with some incompatibility that you just did not know about before. We've tried really hard as developers to go out and interact with the community and do outreach and talk to different users and companies and miners and all the different players and see really what their concerns are and whether they would support something like SegWit. And we got a resounding yes from pretty much like everyone by like the middle of 2016. It was, you know, we were like, yes, we're good to go. And so that's why we deployed it as a miner activated soft fork using BIP9. But I think it turns out that, you know, I mean, obviously there's still some very divergent interests apparently. And it's really, really hard to really, you know, get down to the bottom of it. It's like, what is it that is really causing this contention, right? We can speculate and everything, but there really has been no clear dialogue that really kind of gets to the bottom of it. And it seems like a lot of people are kind of posturing or, you know, like using, thinking of this like a poker game, trying to like, you know, get, you know, the bluff in there and try to find ways to like, you know, exert leverage on other players. And you know, the game theory comes into play now. So now we have a situation where there's a divergence of interest between different groups of the network, where for a while I thought that status quo was the best thing if that were to happen. It's like, great, if people don't agree, then the system stays the same way, and that's great. Immutability is working fine. But I think that right now we've kind of reached a point where there is a conflict. It needs resolution. We need to get to the bottom of what it is that's causing it, or if not, we need to resolve it somehow. I don't think that it's good for just like, you know, the optics and the development of this technology and innovation for us to be stuck, you know, just, you know, arguing over a single technical parameter forever. It just is ridiculous. So we need to show down. And so I support a user activated soft fork because I think the dynamics needs to change. Obviously, the miner activated soft fork is not working. I think for a long time we really feared the possibility of chain splits, and I see, you know, I agree with Simon that it is more complicated to explain to people if you have to explain multiple blockchains, and you know, there's two different Bitcoins, you know, or three different Bitcoins or whatever. But I think that part of the system is just having to deal with those scenarios and understanding the implications and like not fearing them so much. The chain can split. We don't really have control over that. I think that a lot of misconceptions have like, you know, been around the idea that developers can simply change consensus rules and everyone's just going to like adopt, you know, accept whatever happens. But that's not the case at all. I mean, users are the ones that really ultimately dictate the rules of the network. We can make recommendations. And as you mentioned about, you know, the wiki site, right? It's like we posted in there like what our particular opinions are. You see that not all core developers agree all the time on which proposals are the best on different things. When it comes to consensus changes in particular, the bar is set really high. It's really hard to push a consensus change through Bitcoin Core unless there's a very high level of agreement, not only between developers, but within the entire ecosystem. And I think that right now we're just seeing that, I think more and more people are realizing that the status quo is just not, you know, untenable because we need a resolution to this. I'm hoping that, it plays out smoothly. I hope that, you know, everyone kind of works in their own economic self-interest, or at least, in a way that, realizes like the optimal outcome for the system for the majority, you know, of users, really. I think right now this whole idea of one CPU, one vote in the white paper is being, as Jameson said, I think it's being very misinterpreted. If the system were to work that way, as far as, like, you know, one hash, one vote, I don't think Bitcoin would be very interesting at all if you apply that to consensus rules, because that would basically just allow anyone that has, it's just brute force, right? And that's not a system that I find very appealing. I don't think most Bitcoin users do either. I'm very concerned about, I guess flabbergasted that people would keep on attempting this same tactic of trying to, like, you know, forge these kind of agreements in behind closed doors and get everyone to sign off, and that would kind of work. It's already been tried, you know, several times in the past. It's never worked. I don't think that'll ever work on Bitcoin. I think that it's just inherently in direct contradiction to what, you know, the principles behind Bitcoin and what actually keeps Bitcoin together. Different companies might think, well, you know, we have the clout and we have the power to be able to push this through and whatever. But in the end, it's the users that matter. It's you know, Bitcoin users and the markets. And it just seems like the markets don't want this kind of contentious hard fork right now at all. I know fees are getting high. Some people are getting a little upset because, you know, it is pricing out some use cases maybe. But, you know, it's like maybe we're having, like, too much of a good thing. It's the, you know, the price is reaching all-time highs. Today it reached another all-time high, right? So it's like, wow, you know, there's so much demand for this. So many people want this, you know, and it's like it's a victim of its own success in a way. I don't really like the narrative that, you know, oh, Bitcoin's failing and it can't scale because fees are so high or whatever. I mean, it's a new technology, and I think that we're going to be doing some amazing stuff with off-chain stuff, second layer stuff. I think that we could still work on some block, block size limit ideas, you know, at some point. But I think the incentive structure needs to be changed right now, and I think that we need to change the dynamics. So I'm really excited about August 1st. I think that it's a chance to really change this whole thing, and I think that I'm really excited to see what happens.
Absolutely, and so much there to unpack. I mean, just great points, Eric. I mean, it's just strange that, you know, after XT, Classic, and BU continuously gets rejected by the market, they still try to think that, oh, no problem, we'll just sign an agreement and everything will be okay. It's really strange. I mean, because at this point, the market wants SegWit. Clearly, right? After XT, Classic, Bitcoin Limited, the market wants SegWit. It is proven on the testnet for over a year to be, you know, to work, and it was just engineered just with extreme difficulty, you know, by you guys to make sure, by the core team, to make sure that it can please as many people as possible. And again, it's very interesting to me that that last year, you know, that you guys were under the impression for the most part that the miners were okay with SegWit, that, hey, everything was good. And then now, you know, here we are. And we can try to speculate all that we want with ASIC boost and things like that. But look, unless Jihan and Bitmain, you know, come forward and start asking people like Eric, telling people like Eric what the actual problem they have is with SegWit, then we're not going to get anywhere, and we're just going to have to user activate soft fork. I mean, this is just the way it is. If you're not going to talk, then the users will take action, and I kind of feel that's kind of what's happening. Because remember, the developers themselves, they're not dictators. They do not control when the hard fork can happen. They do not control when a soft fork can happen. You know, they can write a bit, but if nobody runs it, it's not going to happen, right? It's up to the users to enforce this and what they really want. So very interesting comments, Eric. Thank you so much. Let's go with John Light, Mr. John. Again, just reminding everybody that you wrote an awesome blog post to prepare people for the user-activated software. That is linked in the video description below. So, John, I just wanted to see, what are your thoughts on the conversation so far, and what do you think about the user-activated software? Are you excited? Are you scared? Do you think it's necessary? Tell us your thoughts.
I'm not scared. Certainly not scared. Because there's one thing that I pointed out in a recent blog post. It's a point that I think is really worth stressing here as well, which is that SegWit is the lowest common denominator across all of the proposals that have wide support right now. Whether you're talking about BIP 148 or BIP 141 or SegWit 2x. The common denominator here is SegWit. Everybody who signed the SegWit 2x agreement agreed to activate SegWit and thus, you know, voicing their support for SegWit. Of course, everybody who wants BIP 141 and 148 to activate wants SegWit. So we have a very wide consensus, very wide agreement that, you know, miners and users agree to activate SegWit. So therefore, you know, I think that wide agreement on activating SegWit that August 1st is going to be a complete non-event.
That would be awesome if it was just yet another non-event. I also seem to remember a whole lot of FUD about the last halving in 2016, about how, you know, it's going to spiral down and the miners aren't going to be able to make profits and everybody's just going to quit, right? They're just going to quit. No, that did not happen. It went off without a hitch across the world. The entire world, all these Bitcoin nodes enforced the rules that were written 8 years ago, and half the supply, in fact, did have. So a very amazing event, and I'm hoping that we can pull off that same type of skills with this on August 1st. But we will have to see. So with that aside, yeah. Does anybody else have anything they want to jump in with before asking another question?
Well, I do want to get into really the nuance of that. So that's kind of a high level overview of kind of how I feel about this SegWit and the user activated soft fork. The nuance here is that the user activated soft fork is happening within the context of this SegWit 2x agreement, which for some unknown reason has decided to actually re-implement SegWit. And instead of activating the existing deployment that's in production, they have decided to activate SegWit using a new deployment method, which means that they have to write new software and roll out new node software to everybody who they want to participate in this new activation. And, you know, This to me is really the most baffling part of it, because it seems to me like they're trying extremely hard to not activate SegWit, even though that's what everybody who signed that agreement, you know, stated that they were going to do. And so, you know, my question to any of the SegWit 2x people is like, you know, what is the reason for this? Why did you choose to re-implement SegWit and activate it with a totally new deployment, rather than simply activating BIP 141 or even 148 if you prefer a flag day and a lower activation threshold, and then do a, you know, a 2 megabyte hard fork in 6 months after SegWit activates, as you know, because that's what's new about this agreement. Really, the what's new about this agreement is not activating SegWit. That was already something that people have agreed to in the past, and this is already software that's in production. What's new about this agreement is this idea that 6 months after SegWit activates, there's going to be a 2 megabyte hard fork. So what I don't understand is why they had to basically bundle a SegWit activation with this 2 megabyte hard fork, rather than just say, well, let's activate via BIP 141 or 148, and then after that, you know, we'll run some software that activates a hard fork in 6 months and see how that goes. It seems to me that all they have done by basically choosing to bundle SegWit with a 2 megabyte hard fork and re-implement SegWit in some new software, all they have done is simply delay the activation of SegWit even further. And you have to ask, why did they do that? Yeah, it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, John. I think it's really right now we're seeing this new dynamic of people just you know, besides signing the agreement, it's like, it seems like a bait and switch. You know, other ones at least were more specific about what they intended to do. You know, XT was very particular about what it wanted to accomplish. Bitcoin Classic was very particular about what it wanted to accomplish, you know, BU. But this one seems like it's a complete bait and switch. It's like, you know, I mean, maybe other attempts also had other intentions in mind. I think, for instance, like, you know, BU really couldn't activate anyways. There was no activation mechanism at all. People just had to kind of like, you know, the hash rate didn't really matter for activation, because if the markets didn't accept the blocks, then they're not valid, right? So in this case, it just seems like, yeah, it seems like more delaying tactics, or I would like at least some explanation that's sensible as to why this is being done. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. Why are we doing this?
So I think from my perspective of what I've seen is, so when this, I spend a lot of time with the miners in China. It's around the corner from me in Hong Kong. And when I sat down with these people, I can tell you this is all politics, human emotions, upset people, egos. It's all of that. It's simply, this agreement is not, sitting down with the core developers or other developers and figuring out how we actually implement this. It's all a political signal of how can we, a business person or a group of business people thinking, what have we got to do to move forward here? So they, they come up with solution. And to me, as a non-technical person, the obvious solution did seem like, well, let's do, let's do this 2 megabytes, satisfy people, and then let's do SegWit and let's satisfy everyone. We can unify and move forward. But once you put that past any of the developers or anyone that's actually qualified to answer upon that, they can actually tell you why that's ridiculous. And so, the motivation behind it is purely, there's a bunch of upset people. The Hong Kong agreement apparently signed. I was there in Hong Kong. People were upset that didn't happen. There was a bunch of altercations. Trust was lost. There's communication barriers. The developers are communicating in a different style than many of the people in China. And then another thing is also, from my perspective of actually speaking with many of the Bitcoin community in China, it's actually, people are actually upset just by that word, Chinese miners, because they all actually have very different opinions and very different perspectives. And many of the people many of them are big SegWit supporters. There's so much to this. It's like, just banding people together into these Chinese miners has upset a lot of people. And that's still, it's just a way that we sort information to try and understand this. But there's a bunch of different players that are upset about a bunch of different things. And, from having spoken to Jihan, he is somebody that's very upset with the communication between core developers and miners. And the ASIC boost was a thing that kind of added new information, and nobody really knows the answer to that, and I guess we're going to find out soon. But this is purely human emotions at play here. And then, you guys, as more understanding the technicals and the practicalities of implementation and actually working on how this is actually going to happen, realize that, this is a very stupid compromise. But it's just a bunch of business people and non-techies trying to figure out, how do we move forward? How do we get Bitcoin back to where we want to be?
Well, I mean, can I jump in just for a sec?
Or go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say, some of us have really been working on these problems of how you deploy new consensus rules on the network professionally for years now. This is what we do. This is our specialty, right? And it's a little bit strange that people that are running these businesses wouldn't come and ask our opinion about these things until they've already kind of decided that they want to do something that we know is not going to work, just because we've studied these scenarios. I do this for a living. This is what I do. I study exactly these kinds of contentious scenarios and try to understand how different players might react and how the protocol might affect, or what can actually be done within the protocol, right? It seems like when my advice has been solicited, for instance, I was really excited about, going to New York and be able to talk to people and actually try to see if we might be able to bring better communications to that. But it seems people already had something in mind, which, I know it's not going to work. It's just, it's not about my own opinion of wanting to be a, like my own ideology or whatever. I mean, this is science. Like, we have a science for this. We know the sentiment, and like we know like how people tend to react to these things just because we have a lot of data in the past, right? We know how the markets react to this stuff. It just seems like, you know, that's why I say I'm flabbergasted that, like, you know, we're not consulted about this before. And then as far as like what Simon was saying about the miners in China, I actually, you know, we actually had two meetings after the Hong Kong thing. I had two meetings myself, and as developers, we had one meeting in Palo Alto last year. And I mean, we talked to them. This was after the Hong Kong thing, and they agreed. Like, all of the miners there, including Jihan and, you know, McCree from Bitmain, agreed that SegWit was a good thing, that they were going to activate. Right. I actually went there myself personally to meet with them in Beijing. A few months ago, and tried to just listen to their concerns. I didn't go there to sell them anything. I wasn't there to sell them SegWit. I specifically told them, I'm not here to try to figure out a complete solution. I just want to hear what you guys' concerns are. What is it that's like bothering you, and how might I be able to address it, right? And, you know, like I felt like, okay, maybe we can like move forward. But every single time that it, you know, like we come to two things that seem very clear as a pattern, you know. People say, yes, we think SegWit is a good technology, right? But no, we don't want to activate it because of some other reason. And the reason is always changing. And maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe it's like a negotiation tactic or whatever you want to call it. Like, it's just, you know, but like, that's just not the way that open source works. And it's hard to explain sometimes to people that, you know, open source development really cannot be pushed forward that way. It just tends to delay it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm still open to talking to anyone that has, you know, concerns and to answer any questions and to be helpful. But like when people don't want to, like, you know, discard your suggestions and advice, it's just like you don't really feel particularly motivated to continue trying to help them. And you just keep on pushing forward. You just keep on working. I mean, as Bitcoin Core developers, we continue to push forward and work on stuff and add new features that are not consensus features necessarily. Right now, I'm working on Litecoin a lot just because it's, you know, a really cool test bed where I can work on engineering again and not have to deal so much with like the politics and all that. And you know, it's just, you just keep on pushing forward, and it's just like, that's just the way you got to do it. And we don't have control over this. I feel like the you know, I'm excited to see this conflict resolved. So, but I still want to see if we can find an amicable solution to this. If we can't though, it still needs to be resolved. So.
Yep, for sure. John, you had something?
Yeah. I have two points, kind of responding to some of the insights that Simon drew out based on his discussions. The first one is that, you know, it's really irrational to bundle SegWit with a 2 megabyte hard fork the way that it's been done, because whether SegWit is activated via SegWit 2x or BIP 141 or 148, the signers to this agreement can always just run software without the hard fork after SegWit activates. And so, you know, I've seen speculation like, oh, the reason why they decided to bundle it together is because then, you know, it's locked in, like everybody who signed it will have to sign the hard fork, and then no one will be able to renege. And it's like, that's not how this works. You know, once SegWit is activated, if all people really wanted was SegWit, then they can just choose to run doesn't support the hard fork later. And you're just not going to get the hard fork in 6 months. These kinds of agreements aren't going to force consensus either onto the people who signed this or to the wider network. And so it's irrational to think that, you know, bundling them together is going to solve this problem where you know, you need consensus among the people who are running the software. And further, you know, for the business people who are thinking, oh, well, we just signed it because we think that this is the only way to get SegWit at this point if the miners are blocking this. Well, this gets down to the heart of the issue and the topic that's at this discussion in the show today, which is the user activated soft fork. Like, why did this come about in the first place? The reason is because you don't actually need to sign these irrational agreements with people who, either don't understand how consensus works or are pretending to not understand how consensus works. If the miners don't go, for example, activating SegWit via BIP 141, we do have an alternative activation mechanism other than signing these irrational agreements, which is a user-activated soft fork. We don't need to make irrational compromises like SegWit2x and bow to these irrational demands to bundle things together. We can do a technically correct thing, and which is, you know, activate set of BIP 141 and give strong incentives to miners to upgrade as well using an economy-backed user-activated soft fork. If everybody who had signed the SegWit2x agreement had instead, or perhaps in parallel if that was, you know, politically feasible, but if they had instead said we're going to support the BIP 148 user-activated soft fork by August 1st, we're going to be enforcing BIP 148, I think the miners would get in line pretty quickly. At least once, as August 1st kind of drew closer, because miners need to make money from the blocks that they mine, and if the economy that signed this agreement, the major exchanges, the major wallet developers, the major brokers, and other economic nodes, decided, after August 1st, we're rejecting any blocks that aren't, signaling for SegWit, then, the miners have a choice. They can signal for SegWit or they can go broke. And, so this is like, obviously, it's a tough choice for us to offer to the miners, but like, if they're not doing what the users want, this is our right to basically say, look, we don't want to do business with miners that aren't going to give us this beneficial upgrade that solves a lot of problems in the network right now. And so you have a choice. You can either come with us, your own fork, and try to either convince some of the economy to join you on the other side, or you can go out of business. And this SegWit2x thing, it's proving that miners can get the economy to do irrational things, and I think that that's a bad precedent.
It is a bit of a strange situation, the SegWit2x. I mean, they're literally rewriting SegWit. They're literally taking code that's already done and in production and then attempting to modify it and stick it into this SegWit2x with a hard fork, and it does kind of baffle the mind. I mean, and it's also strange that they continue to threaten with hard forks, right? Like Jihan has already threatened with a hard fork, and people have threatened with hard forks before with XT and things like that. And it's like, look, you can threaten all you want, but at the end of the day, this is game theory. You're going to go with what is economically sound, or you'll go out of business. And no one, I think, in my opinion, is going to want to mine a chain without SegWit. It's just ludicrous. So yeah, very interesting stuff. I think we can go with Jameson. Did you have any additional points?
Well, I mean, I think John's correct that technically it doesn't make sense to try to bundle this, but I think that I can see some logic in it, which is mainly a holdover of the past few years, that the legacy that we've built of doing minor signaling of readiness to do some sort of change. And so while you can't, technically force someone to follow their signaling, we have been rolling out various functionality via miner signaling. I think that if anything, that some of the miners, especially Wang Chun and F2Pool, have really shown that miner signaling is not really worth much at all when it comes down to contentious activation of features. But on the other hand, there's also been this misconception built up that I think it goes back to the whole Nakamoto consensus, machine consensus versus meatspace consensus conflagration, where people are confusing all of these things, where people are now thinking that miner signaling to enforce new rules is equivalent to voting. And this is not a fucking political game that we are playing here. This, as many people have said, is game theory. This is us trying to build out a system. Like we have, you know, a nearly 10-year-long process now of rolling out changes to this system, going through very long and yet sometimes hand-wavy, you know, meat-space consensus decision-making of trying to figure out what the best path forward is. But like once a feature has been highly vetted and the code is written, has been tested, and a lot of people seem to be in favor of it, once it's out there, the miner's job is not to vote on whether or not they think that it's a good idea. The miner's job is to run the code and let the users take advantage of all of the hard work that has been put into writing, testing, and now deploying it. So that's why the soft fork may end up being, you know, the last straw of us proving to the miners that they are not nearly as powerful as they think they are. It may have been the result of years of consolidation and years of miners becoming extremely wealthy that has resulted in them thinking that they run the system. And if that's the case, then unfortunately, they may have to learn a very hard lesson. And the really unfortunate part is that it may end up being a hard lesson for the rest of the community as a result, at least for temporary period of time when there may be some chaos of the system not performing quite as well as it should if people had just fallen along the lines of the game theory that's already there that they seem to be very ignorant or not want to believe in.
I wanted to just say one thing about what Simon says about the miners not being all like this homogenous entity that's, you know, everyone has like the same things. And I mean, I think that when we talk about miners having specific interests, I do want to clarify that I have talked to a lot of different big mining pool operators, and they all have very different personalities. I get along with several of them very well. Some of them are very nice guys. I really, really like to talk to them, and I keep in touch with them today even. And so it's really only a small number of the mining pool operators and miners. And, you know, I think it's really important that people realize that the disproportionate amount of house power that a small number of people control, and how that's totally antithetical to the whole notion of decentralization. And I think, you know, it's fine if people have found ways to become more efficient at something, and there's obviously going to be specialization in any field. I think that, you know, professional mining is obviously an area of specialization now that's become, you know, very much a professional enterprise. This kind of, you know, attitude or like sense of entitlement that now it's like because they can do that, now they can just change the rules or like, you know, somehow impose on the rest of the users of the system, you know, that we should accept specific, you know, compromises or changes that they want just because of that, you know, or to stall changes that the rest of the user community wants just because they happen to control more hash power. That's just not a system that seems very interesting to me. So like that's why I'm supporting the user-activated soft fork and an end to this, even though I think that, you know, status quo, if there were other kinds of situations, maybe status quo would be the best option. It just seems like it's necessary to demonstrate conclusively that it's not the case that this whole myth is, the, you know, that we're you know, one CPU, one vote actually means this.
Yep. I think, Simon, did you have something you wanted to add?
Actually, I had a question of the guys here. Does UASF open up a new attack vector in the future that we're not seeing right now? Like, if we set the precedent that we can do it this way, does that set you know, the motion that other players might come along and I don't know, is there new attack vectors coming here? I think, you know, someone mentioned was, what if the US government wanted to activate a UASF and they had the ability to put some hash power behind that? What is there anything that we might not be seeing here or that comes from this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Any change, anything like this will set a new precedent and it could introduce new attack vectors. I think we're like in uncharted territory. It's still this, you know, huge capitalistic experiment that we're all participating in. We don't really know exactly how things might unwind later on. I think that the attack vectors that we're seeing right now with the hash power, though, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you patch one thing, one security hole, and like you introduce some other security hole. Yeah, there could be other security vulnerabilities introduces. However, we know that there is a security vulnerability right now that is being exploited, and that needs to be patched. So whether this patch will introduce new opportunities, I mean, yeah, it's possible that someone's able to, I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's not really about hash power with the user-activated soft fork. It's more about market power. Can markets really be manipulated that much to be able to have someone actually force this? And you know, I think that the whole transparency of Bitcoin makes it really hard for someone to be able to, I mean, obviously markets can be manipulated. There's no question about that. But whether a particular change in the protocol actually has markets for it or against it, I mean, yeah, there could be someone that creates a campaign to kind of distort that and, you know, create this whole, you know, maybe like mob mentality that we need to enforce something right away that maybe doesn't make too much sense. But that can happen now anyways. I mean, that's something that I think, you know, no matter what we do, is an attack vector that exists. So I think it's best to just patch the security holes that we know about right now and, you know, hope, I mean, do it in the way that we know that it's the most secure way that we can think of. And then, you know, keep on learning and see what we can do in the future.
Yep. Jameson or John, did you want to, also comment on that question at all?
We have to remain versatile. I mean, you know, this is a system that is really built around security, and we've already found that, you know, we didn't fully understand all of the incentives of the actors, and we have no reason to believe that we fully understand all of the incentives of the actors in the system even today. And this, I guess, kind of goes back to really my thesis that I wrote an article about of how no one really understands Bitcoin, and that we're discovering more about it every day, every month, every year. And it really is this thing that is very hard to describe and define, because it's almost taken on a life of its own.
Yep, absolutely. And it is kind of strange. Like, I think that we now, we didn't fully, speaking of not fully understanding, like, I don't think we fully understood how much power Jihan had prior to Ant Bleed and ASIC Boost, right? If you look back and think about it, if Jihan knew about that and nobody else knew, maybe that makes more sense where when he was tweeting about things like, they have no idea what's coming, right? Well, we did not. But guess what? Because Bitcoin is this, you know, this open system, somebody leaked it. Somebody found out. And that should be the case going forward. If there's ever something that's going to undermine Bitcoin, at some point it will be outed by somebody, because Bitcoin itself is protecting itself at this point. It is now large enough to where it can protect itself, should be able to protect itself from virtually anything that comes to mind at this point. I mean, if you ask me, Antbleed, the combination of Antbleed and ASIC Boost, that should have taken down Bitcoin. Like, Jihan could have flipped the switch, things could have split. I mean, just all sorts of crazy things. But yet, here we are, new all-time highs, you know, everybody more excited than ever before. And we got this user-activated software taking back the power, giving the power back to the users. And so this is just, you know, amazing times for me, I think. And so I think I'm going to just underline one more point from, you know, from Jameson. This is not a game, right? This is not a game. There is game theory that's going to in place, that is in place, that is going to wreck any of your thoughts that you think that you're in control. Nobody is in control with Bitcoin. If anything, the users are in control. So very interesting points. Does anybody else have anything to add on this? Otherwise, I'm going to ask another UASF question. Nope. Okay. So then let me ask maybe Jameson and Eric this, because this is a bit more of a technical question. You know, on Mad Bitcoin's interview with Jimmy Song, Jimmy actually might have been on the Bitcoin group on the World Crypto Network. Jimmy Song claimed that he had run the numbers, and that ASIC Boost would really only maybe costing or giving Bitmain a couple of million dollars of year advantage tops. And I just wanted to know, maybe from you guys first, Jameson, and then Eric, just does that sound plausible? If ASIC Boost was the thing, first of all, does that sound right? Like, ASIC Boost is only worth a couple million. And B, does that sound plausible that, you know, this might have been something that Jihan was using to not activate SegWit? Go with Jameson first.
I mean, maybe not. I mean, I'm not all that well versed in all the details of Jihan's mining operation. I'm not sure that it really matters. I mean, I think that the bigger problem is simply how centralized mining and, you know, chip fabrication has become at this point. Whether or not there is like a 30% gain here and there, you can make arguments about how good or bad that is. But like, I think that we are so far away from what the ideal mining scenario would be that I'm not really as concerned about that. Like long term, you know, I've really held to the idea of really almost more of the Balaji, have a, you know, toaster in everybody's house that's doing a little bit of completely trivial mining, like, you know, the near perfect decentralized mining. There's the question is just how do we scale out to that point? And of course that could be a very, you know, decades long type of problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'd say that any advantage, you know, even if it's small, in a zero sum market where there are very slim margins, is huge. So I don't really think that, you know, how much of an additional income comes just from the ASIC boost thing is really, I mean, the point is, it's a monopolistic practice. It pushes out competitors. Giving a particular miner a disproportionate amount of hash rate, even if it's not entirely just about ASIC boost, just being able to do that for a while, just collecting all the fees that are coming in from, you know, the congestion right now, and you know, the distribution of those fees is distributed according to the hash power, you know, of the pools. Having particular players have a disproportionate amount of that hash power. There's so many places where, you know, miners could potentially be getting revenues directly or indirectly from something like ASIC boost. So from a strategic perspective, it obviously is a centralization vector, a very strong centralization pressure on the network. And I think it needs to be fixed.
Absolutely.
Can I just throw in one more thing?
Oh,
also,
please.
I mean, there's obviously the whole patent issue, right? Which is also a problem. I mean, I think if it were to be something that you know, everyone could use ASIC boost or something like that, we might be able to avoid the patent issue if it really was you know, but I mean, it interferes with the protocol. So it just seems like you know, it would be in everyone's interest to just disable it completely. And I think that, you know, whether or not Jimmy Song's numbers are correct, I don't think that that's really the point.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. So let me ask Simon this, see what he thinks of this opinion. So, I mean, SegWit 2x and, you know, all the previous fork attempts, XT, Classic, BU, and then BU again, all these previous attempts, they're all incompatible with Core, right? Including SegWit2x. I mean, is SegWit2x just yet another attempt to remove Core from development?
Well, that's what it looks like from, I mean, a lot of people think that that's the optics of it. Obviously, you know, just forking the repository and trying to kind of, you know, have new developers jump in and completely change it in ways that are, you know, incompatible. And just like the way that I've seen the project emerge is really disturbing given the initial statement that Barry Silber showed me. You know, the statement that I was shown was that SegWit was going to activate immediately. I mean, everyone, I think, understood that that meant SegWit, as in the one that we have right now. I think that most of the people that were agreeing to that statement understood it that way. At least several that I've spoken to understood it to be that way. And then several afterwards did not sign the agreement. And several since have told me that they just don't like the way that it's gone at all, right? So I don't know. It just seems like maybe the people that are trying to, you know, like there's maybe like a, you know, people that don't really understand the development process, or I'd like to try to assume, you know, non-malicious intent. So maybe, you know, that could be an explanation that just people that feel like they can just throw money at stuff and get stuff done, which makes sense in some contexts. It doesn't make sense for a consensus network like this, would feel that they could do to this also. But it's just, I don't know. It's throwing it more incompatibilities out there, either is naive or it's a stalling tactic. I don't see any rational reason to do it other than if you wanted to stall progress.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that SegWit 2 megs was an attempt to take core out of the equation. It's clear, you know, that Roger gave his opinions about the core developers, and BU was an attempt to do that, an overhaul of the developers and put a new system of developers in. I just think it was trying to achieve what UASF has achieved, which is putting a date and moving forward. And I think Barry and everybody that signed that is going to be happy to say, okay, well, it, UASF it is then. This was our attempt to try and put a date in the diary. Now we've got a date in the diary, so let's all move forward with that. I don't, from my observation, there wasn't much more to it than that.
Sounds right. Does anybody have anything else?
Well, I just want to say that I think that initially the intention might have been exactly what Simon is saying, and I'm hoping that, I mean, I think that maybe that is the case, but whether or not that is the case, I mean, the project has clearly been hijacked. The direction it's taken is clearly not that. So it's not going to work. It's clearly not going to bring the community together behind this thing to rally for it and to make sure that everyone agrees to do this. It's actually created more fissures, I think. So it just seems like a non-starter at this point. I think that the user-activated soft fork is the only possible way forward right now that seems plausible that might actually work. So I agree.
Very interesting. All right. So let me just ask, if nobody else has anything else to comment, let me just ask Simon then, when do you think the exchanges are going to start saying things? Because we, Tone Vase was speculating that they have to start saying things pretty soon. In my opinion, they really got to start speaking up for sure by the end of this month, if not beginning of the July at the latest. They have to start saying what their plans are. And so I was wondering from you guys, Simon, first, when do you think they're going to start speaking up?
I think it's around the corner. You know, I we're investors in Bitfinex, Bitstamp, Kraken, and many others. You know, Coin, Bitso, and you know, so we're invested in this whole community. And I've been sending messages and the Skype messages across. And they just got to be very careful. There's a lot of planning here. Anything they say has got to be really, really thought of. You can't just come out with an impulsive tweet here or anything. You got to really think through this stuff. Everything has consequences. But I think we're gonna start to see something soon. The exchanges need to do that, because at the end of the day, they a lot of people, as we said right at the beginning, a very small percentage of Bitcoiners are actually involved or engaged in this actual debate and actually know it. The vast majority don't have any idea of, you know, what's actually coming up or what's happening. So the exchanges have a ginormous responsibility, because, you know, not for lack of trying, everyone tells people to take your Bitcoins off exchanges, but the reality is that people don't. So, you know, no exchange wants to lose a vast majority of people's money, and they have to just take responsibility for people here. And so I'm sure the announcements will come out here, and I'm not too concerned about, you know, what the exchanges will do from here, because I think they've got a ginormous incentive and interest to make sure that all of the people that have coins on their exchange are protected, and they get to preserve that value. But you know, I think everyone's, again, there's another game theory between exchanges, who's going to be first. So, you know, with Bitcoin Unlimited, Bitfinex made the first move to actually create, you know, a way of you speculating on Bitcoin Unlimited versus Bitcoin Core, or the Bitcoin that Core were developing. And my experience is Bitfinex has been very innovative in this space. I think it's just coming soon. It's just a question of making sure they've got all their ducks lined up, the strategy is clear, and they're communicating it in a responsible way.
Absolutely. John, we'll go with you next. What do you think the exchanges are going to start speaking up? And should we all start emailing our exchanges to tell them what's going on?
So one thing to point out is that, you know, most of the economy, at least the representatives of the economy, economy in terms of the exchanges and brokers and other large sources of liquidity have signed the SegWit 2x agreement. And so I think in the interest of trying to preserve the weak consensus that they have there, I think the exchanges are not going to try to rock the boat. But if time goes on and there's going to be continue to be more pressure building, if not, you know, from the leadership in the exchanges, certainly from their customers who are, who are at least, you know, Bitcoin believers and want to see this go through. And so, you know, absolutely, I would encourage everybody who wants to see SegWit activate on the network to, encourage your exchanges and your wallet developers and everybody else who's running economic nodes that essentially represents you on the network. Tell them to enforce BIP 148 because that will ensure that SegWit on August 1st. And if we have the economy behind us, it's going to also bring the miners over to our side as well, because miners want to make money. And the economy is where the money is at. And if the economy is on one side, it's pretty clear where the miners are going to end up as well. So, I would like to see the SegWit 2x version of SegWit activate. Whether we get SegWit through 141 or 148 or SegWit 2x, it really makes no difference to me. But, you know, the fact that they have to, like, re-implement the software and do several rounds of testing and deploy that software across a large number of nodes and stuff, you know, that's all very time-consuming, whereas BIP 141 is deployed in production today. And so that's the fastest way to activate SegWit. And BIP 148 is just a new activation method, the current deployment. So I think in my opinion 141 and 148 are the fastest ways to get. So if SegWit 2x ends up taking longer than expected, there's no reason at all why we can't take the very large amount of consensus that is around activating SegWit and converting that into action and activate SegWit by August 1st.
Yep, absolutely. Sounds good to me. Jameson, what do you think about the exchanges? When do you think they're going to get on board? And maybe tell us a little bit about how BitGo is handling this.
So this entire debacle has put me in a pretty tricky position. So, I mean, I am personally responsible for maintaining BitGo's fleet of full nodes, which are used by I don't even know how many customers, but lots of the big exchanges. Now, as far as I am aware, I have not had any conversations with any exchanges about any of this. Then again, I haven't really been a big part, like I wasn't in any sort of inner circle for SegWit 2x. Like everything that I said about SegWit 2x, I said publicly on the GitHub issues. And my personal opinion is that I would think that one of the best chances that we would have of avoiding a messy situation on August 1st is perhaps some sort of fast-tracked BIP 91. Basically, anything that will activate the existing SegWit deployment on BIP 1, you know, before that August 1st deadline would avoid a lot of unnecessary trouble. Whether or not it's SegWit 2x or something else, I'm ambivalent. I'm not as worried about the hard fork part about SegWit 2x because that's another 6 months away. So I would at least like to be able to see, you know, SegWit activated, working on the network, see how it affects the network for a number of months before we then have to get back into another similar situation of, oh no, another fork is coming up potentially. You know, how are we going to deal with it? So it's a really tricky situation for me and for BitGo because we cannot unilaterally make any decisions on our own. We cannot claim to represent the very diverse array of customers and people that are on our platform. I'm not even sure that if we sent out a poll along those lines, you know, whether or not we would then, you know, make a decision just based upon a poll. So I would say, you know, John is on the right track of like, you should definitely be sending messages to all of your exchanges and other large economic entities. Let them know what you think. I would like to see more and more trustworthy futures markets. So it seems to me that if this type of situation can't be resolved easily at the technical level, then it's going to come down to the financial, economic level, and potentially even whales battling it out, dumping the coins on whatever chain fork that they disagree with. And I would definitely like to avoid that type of situation. And if we think that it does come down to whales battling it out, I would prefer that they battle it out in their own little cages called future markets so that they can leave the rest of us out of it. But that's just my opinion. At the end of the day, as much power as I have over the full nodes at BitGo, I really don't have the decision-making capability, or really even the right, I think, to make a decision on behalf of all the people that are using our full nodes.
Jameson, just one point of clarification. So I think Mike Belshi actually was kind of sent out the first email with the SegWit 2x roadmap, and so in some ways BitGo is making these decisions on behalf of all of their customers. And so while you personally cannot as a company leadership level BitGo was first incorporated, there was a deliberate decision made to say, we're going to run Bitcoin instead of, BTCD or something like that. And so there's another deliberate decision that's going to be made to say, we're running this new SegWit 2x software instead of a Bitcoin core. And so, I want to clarify that point, just for the audience, that while you personally might not be able to make this decision, there are lots of companies who are responsible for running economic nodes on behalf of their customers who really do have the responsibility to make wise decisions on behalf of their customers. And then it's up to the customers to decide, am I going to stay with this company and continue relying on them on their full nodes, or do I find a new UTXO provider or infrastructure provider to represent me on the network?
Yeah, sure. Though I will say that there may have been some initial misunderstanding around BitGo's participation in this, and we have definitely not committed to running SegWit 2x code, at least as of today, as far as I'm aware. We've only committed to trying to help further that cause. I would like to see, some sort of furthering. Like I said, I really care about the Bit1 activation of SegWit. But at the moment, BitGo is not running SegWit 2x in production. I think, we will try to follow the testing schedule to try to help out with the testing and perhaps eventual deployment of it. But at the moment, I don't even know if or when we might switch our full nodes to run that software.
Okay, thank you for that point of clarification.
Yep, very interesting. Thank you, Jameson. Let's go with Eric. What do you think about all this?
So, there's very little room for error in this kind of software. The smallest kind of bug can create havoc in the whole system, right? So when we worked on SegWit, for instance, we spent months testing it on several test nets, and it, just a lot of work went into making sure that it worked as it is. And so the thing that we've deployed right now, which is activated on Litecoin and several other blockchains, really has been very, very, very well tested. 2 months or however long is left until, whatever the deployment schedule, I guess July something or other, is just really short even for much simpler changes in Bitcoin Core. I mean, we would never think to deploy something that has been untested, that has this much, these many ramifications and implications for the whole system in this short of a period of time. I feel it's very irresponsible. I think that And especially given that the process is not really, it hasn't really received that much, that much review, and there's just so much that goes into making sure that this is safe. So I would definitely, you know, advise exchanges to be very, very careful about what software they're running. I think, you know, obviously there's inherent risk with any kind of changes to the software, but I think that you can make pretty informed decisions about it, understand what the situation is, what the risks are. And as far as BIP 148, even if the majority of the hash rate were not to go on there, you know, you could think of it as kind of like an altcoin temporarily, right? If it does come to overcome or to get over 50% hash rate, then it would basically at some point reorg the other chain. But I would like to see, like Jameson said, like people to have futures markets where they can battle it out there and not have to drag the rest of us down into that. I really hope, my sincere hope is that miners just activate SegWit. That was my hope, that when Barry Silbert told us, hey, we're going to try to activate SegWit, great, let's activate SegWit, you know. Activate SegWit that's out there right now running on 80% or more of the nodes on the network that are ready, that they're ready to go. It's been tested. It works fine on other networks. Let's just do that. That's the least risky option for everyone.
I really do feel like SegWit 2x is being very irresponsible with their timeframes. And they're clearly, we know the clear motivation why they're doing this, right? They're trying to get in advance, get their signaling in advance of the user-activated soft fork on August 1st. That's the clear motivation. But this is just super irresponsible, trying to have 2 weeks of beta, 2 weeks of alpha, a couple weeks of testing. I mean, that is just ridiculous when you're talking about close to a $50 billion network. It seems quite ludicrous to me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is just like something that, definitely, it's... It boggles me. It's like I'm flabbergasted.
We're at a loss for words, Eric. Yeah. We're at a loss for words. We just don't know. But I think that can about do it for the topics. You know, I just have one quick question for everybody before we start asking Simon a couple questions. Just maybe if I can just go through one by one and get everybody's like opinion of the state of Bitcoin. Do they feel bullish? Are they scared? Are they excited? So let's just go with Simon. Simon, what do you think about Bitcoin right now and its future? Are you still excited as it was, as you were in the beginning?
Well, I haven't sold a coin since I've been in Bitcoin. You know, I spend them. We pay our staff with them. We do things with them. We use them. But no, I mean, you know, I'm here for Bitcoin becoming more and more of a store of value, becoming a global savings account for the world, becoming an exit for countries like Venezuela that really need an exit. I'm here for it becoming, you know, a hedge against the systemic risk in banking. And I'm here for it having an incredibly amazing payment system attached to it where you can send any amount of value around the world. And to me, expensive Bitcoin is still bloody cheap Bitcoin relative to the value that it actually produces. And you know, this is too important. You know, and I really appreciate the conservative attitude. You know, I mean, you know, a bank to the future. We release technology, but we haven't got 50 billion on the line. If we've got a bug or a problem, you know, we just say, oh, sorry, users. We put it in maintenance mode. And then we fix the bug. You know, that's not an option with Bitcoin. And this is far too important. So, you know, if from listening to everything that's come out through this debate, I'm still really bullish. And I think one thing that's really come out is I think we're all wiser. I think I've learned so much about Bitcoin that I didn't know. I've learned, you know, and everybody has had to engage in this. So it's been a tremendously useful thing. But as soon as we get over this, I mean, I can't imagine what the effect on the price is going to be when we see SegWit activate. And at the end of the day, everybody in this system, miners to developers to people being paid in Bitcoin, to those who are engaging it, to newbies, to those who are investing in ICOs to make more Bitcoin, they are all incentivized by, you know, this incredible experiment that actually has been created right now. And we all need a better Bitcoin. But, you know, if it means that the price is going to crash and there's going to be some turbulence in these decisions, then so be it. But I promise you that what has happened and what has been created in Bitcoin, this story is never going to be repeated again. You know, Ethereum story is different. Litecoin story is different. the story of what Bitcoin has created is never, ever going to be created again. And that means that whatever happens from this, everybody's going to get around. And, you know, what needs to happen for everybody to reach consensus? I'm not actually sure, but I know they will reach consensus in the end, because this is too important for too many people. So I'm completely bullish. And, you know, I'm not a short-term speculator. I'm a long-term holder, and I don't really care if it needs to correct a couple of thousand in order to for everyone to be motivated and to come together again, because I know that once it does activate and we get through this, you know, we're off to the races.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't imagine the price. Like you said, if SegWit activates, I mean, come on, we're in five digits. We got to be in five digits. So very interesting. John, what about you, man? What do you think? Are you still bullish? You still in love with Bitcoin? What do you think about the state of Bitcoin right now?
I'm not going anywhere.
Well, that sounds good to me.
It's on my shirt. Like, just run it. Just go.
Just run BTC, people. That's all you got to do. Just invest in Bitcoin, and your life will be amazing. Jameson,
yeah, it's not that simple. You shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. And you know, this has been a bumpy ride from the very beginning. But Bitcoin has survived far worse than what's happening right now, and what could potentially happen on August 1st. And the difference is number of people that it could affect, which is not insignificant, but at the same time. And I really just can't enough. Like, there is no controversy. Almost everybody is in unanimous agreement that we should activate SegWit. The only disagreement is how. Is not really, like, the answer is very, very clearly obvious, you know, how we should do it. But first, since I don't sell coins, and I don't play a strategy anytime soon. Certainly not over something that has as widely as widespread support as a SegWit.
John is not selling his coins, people. Do not try to ask him to buy coins. Jameson, well, what is your sentiment right now with the state of Bitcoin? How do you feel?
Well, Bitcoin has experienced some minor setbacks, if you get my drift. But I think at the end of the day, Bitcoin keeps moving forward. This is all about permissionless innovation. You know, people can upset the game theory at times and stall things, slow things down, cause more frustration. This happens, you know, on every side of the debate is people causing frustration with the other side because we can't just cooperate once in a while and get along. But it doesn't matter because Bitcoin is not dead until there is consensus that it is dead. And I think that, you know, this is really what we found at the scaling panel that I moderated in New York, was that despite all of the disagreement about, you know, the path that Bitcoin should take, we're all still extremely optimistic and bullish that one way or another, we are going to take a path. And we are going to take that path together. So while it may not be a path that some people are particularly enthusiastic about it, we're going to continue building the system. I think a lot of the people who are involved in the system at this point are the builders, because there's still a lot left to be built. And we're going to build in a way that doesn't require asking permission. I think we may have made some mistakes in asking for permission. And so this is something that I mentioned recently, that, you know, even if a worst case scenario of Bitcoin never got SegWit, Bitcoin never got Lightning Network, then that's not going to deter us. We can already build payment channels based solutions that just aren't quite as optimized as what we would like. And so, you know, if we run out of road on one path, then we'll just take another path forward and keep on going. And there's no end to this until we all agree to give up on it.
No end, people. No end indeed. Eric, give us your thoughts, man. What do you think about the state of Bitcoin? Are you excited still?
I'm very excited. I'm very bullish. It's interesting because when I first got into Bitcoin, I thought it was a proof of concept. It's just a prototype, and it's eventually going to maybe be replaced by something else. But it's proved so resilient over the time, and it's really we've found so many new cool things that we can do on top of it. All this payment channel stuff is absolutely fascinating. I think the vision with that is just amazing what we can actually accomplish, like a whole decentralized internet, you know, machine-to-machine payments and, you know, just what it enables, all these use cases that are just not practical right now with typical payment systems that exist right now. So I'm really, really excited about all that. I think that we need to push through and get this done. And if, you know, I'm hoping that it'll happen on Bitcoin. If it doesn't happen on Bitcoin, it's not like I think that, well, that's the end of it. I think that the technology is actually more important than the network itself. I would love to see Bitcoin succeed. I'm bullish on it right now. I'm holding Bitcoin. I think that it's great to, you know, it seems like there's only upside right now, but I don't want to, you know, make long-term predictions as far as, I think there's so many things that can happen with this, but yeah, I'm very bullish right now.
Awesome. So I think we're all in agreement here, people. Bitcoin is going nowhere, and we are going nowhere. So very awesome. Thanks so much, guys. We're just gonna switch to the second half of the show here, where we ask Simon some questions. If you guys got to go, that's fine. We understand, but we're just gonna spend another 30 minutes here tops, or 25 minutes here tops, asking Simon a couple questions. I'll ask the first question. Simon, I was just wondering here, with all the ICO investments, you know, recently passing VC funding in the blockchain market, over 400 million, maybe you can describe the state of ICOs right now and where you think this is heading if it doesn't crash in the next year or two. Like, how does that affect your business and Bank to the Future? You're still on mute, Simon. Sorry, still on mute.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because I guess you've got to look at what's the future of this. So ICOs have come around as a way of allowing retail investors to invest any amount that they want using crypto in the protocols. Now, at the moment, you can't actually do that as a company, because really, ICO is a way of circumventing regulations. And as a company, you can't actually, issue equity on a blockchain without actually following securities law. Whether it's on a blockchain or whether it's not, you still have to follow securities law. So ICOs is a niche user case for protocols. If ICOs actually becomes a way for companies raising funding, then you just got to look at what is the efficiency improvement there, because if companies are raising finance for it, then you still have to follow securities law, because the definition of an investment contract is the giving of money under the management control of others with the expectation of a return. And everybody's investing in these ICOs right now. They're giving money, which is essentially under the management and control of the people running the code, with an expectation of a return. But at the moment, because it's kind of protocol, they're using ways around that. So if it turns out that ICOs are actually something that can come disruptive to the IPO market, to the venture capital market, then that essentially is what you're saying, is regulations being disrupted. And that is the question, really. Are governments around the world going to allow regulations to be disrupted? And regulations were created as originally as a way of consumer protections, because in the 1920s, people lost a lot of money when people were selling securities. We're kind of in this very interesting phase at the moment. Now, the problem with the ICO market that I see at the moment is that people are raising too much money too quickly. The other problem from the company side, that's a problem. The reason it might seem like a good problem to have, but it means that people are receiving too much money without having proven what they can actually do with that money. And it also creates skews incentives where people become rich after the ICO, and therefore once they're rich after the ICO, they've got no incentive anymore to actually build the technology. Their job is just to create a load of announcements that pumps the price at that point. And so we're in this very, very strange scenario. Now, you know, while a lot of the new ideas and new protocols, what they're tending to do at the moment is they're trying to shoehorn themselves into the ICO model. So they're making their businesses really weird by trying to create a token. And you know, the analogy that I give is if the ICO markets disrupt the IPO markets, then essentially Apple will delist from the stock exchange and say, I'll do an ICO. Because why would they go through all the regulations and all that stuff and all the, you know, the incredible costs that they need to go through of being listed on a public market when you could do the ICO unregulated? And then in order to fit into the ICO model, what would you need to do? Well, you're saying we're going to create our own currency. And this currency can only be used in order to purchase our products. So imagine what would happen to the price of Apple tokens if all they could do, if suddenly when you walked into the Apple store, you had to actually purchase this weird fluctuating value currency, and the cost of your iPad goes up and down every second based upon whether people are speculating on that. Now, how many iPads do you think Apple would be selling if they forced everyone to do that? Well, immediately they'd create a little pump in the price, but then they'd realize that actually consumers don't want to use these tokens to buy products, and they don't want the value of they don't want the price of their products to fluctuate. So, you know, it's a very strange model. So, you know, and it's all around this model of trying to circumvent regulations. Now, a lot of the people doing these ICOs are actually creating a business model that just doesn't work anymore. And so therefore everything's around trying to pump the price, and everyone investing in the ICOs, because the ICO has no reflection of actually underlying value, net asset value, because the value of these ICOs, if it was on a non-speculative market, is essentially the users. So if you look at the history of Bitcoin, why is Bitcoin valuable now? Is because it's actually got more users than it had speculators. And so, you know, short term, it used to be, you know, Bitcoin in the early days when I was around in those really early days, it was all about how many US dollars you could make out of owning Bitcoin. And if everyone was honest with themselves, they were investing in Bitcoin to try and make more US dollars. Well, now with Bitcoin, it's completely shifted. People are taking their US dollars and they're trying to get Bitcoin. And because Bitcoin has become this store of value. And that means that it's shifted from speculative value to utility value. And there's a lot of user cases for Bitcoin that, you know, that can only be used with Bitcoin, that can only be done with Bitcoin. So the value of these ICOs are actually how many users are using them. Now, the reason that Ethereum has suddenly become valuable is because people are actually using Ethereum now to create ICOs. So Ethereum has become a crowdfunding platform. And the utility of buying ETH is so that you can buy more ICOs, and then you can convert those ICOs back into Bitcoin, and you can accumulate more Bitcoin. So we've created this circular economy. And then the value really of these ICOs should be, how many users do they have? And the answer is virtually none, because people don't want to take a token to buy a product that fluctuates in value, but they do want to speculate on that. So you know, you've created all these really interesting, strange models. You know, at Bank to the Future, because we have to follow regulations, we can't, you know, take on retail investors. We can only take on high net worth and accredited investors. And you know, then you've got to ask yourself the question: if ICOs do become securities because they are disrupting the public markets or they are disrupting the venture capital markets, then the token will just become a security. It is close to a security now. And in that case, you just have to follow the exact same rules that we've taken so long at Bank to the Future to comply with. And then you've got to really ask the question, and this is kind of the thing we're debating as a team right now. Is there any benefit in having a token that represents equity when you have to follow securities law? My guess is that there may not be. There might be some interesting form of smart contracts where you can enforce the legal contracts behind the equity. And so these are kind of the things that we're going through right now. But without a doubt, you know, the reason that the ICOs is because people are using them to make more ETH or to make more Bitcoin. And the it really doesn't matter if they build the product or something actually happens here. It's just a question of how many announcements can you make where the original speculators are able to exit. So, you know, when I first started speaking out on this topic, I started looking at some of the irrational behavior that we've seen. You know, we had the speculative drive has got so high that, you know, like the storage, you know, we're equity investors in storage. We're also, I invested in the tokens and the ICO. But, you know, at one point they were 50 cents and they were trading on the market at about 80 to 90 cents. So you could buy them in the ICO for 50 cents, yet people were still paying 80 to 90 cents for them. And this is the irrationality of new people coming into the market. For example, the blockchain capital, you know, the blockchain capital, a lot of the investors were like, this is the worst investment ever. It's only four times the net asset value right now. You know, the value of the blockchain capital, they hadn't, you know, they'd made a few investments, but the value hadn't gone up. It was still worth $1, yet it was trading on the market at $4. So people were paying three times the net asset value. Just simply because it was a token and an ICO. So, you know, eventually these things have to return to utility. But the thing is that fundamental analysis doesn't really matter in the short term. As long as people are speculating and speculative value is a premium on top of actual utility, you've got this market. But eventually it does need to return. It's just a question of what is the black swan, what is the catalyst that's going to make that happen? My guess is that it's going to be when you know, the SEC comes along and puts some enforcement action, and that will be the catalyst because it takes away the main user case of Ethereum and the main user case of the ICO, with the exception of, you know, some very niche businesses that have protocol funding. And but it's an incredibly interesting experiment. I'm happy to speculate as much as anyone else on these ICOs. And if there is a short-term bubble that allows us to, you know, or me to increase my Bitcoin position, then I'll do that. And then what we're seeing right now is, you know, for example, a Bank to the Future, we allow people to invest with altcoins if they want it. We shapeshift them all into Bitcoin. And we allow people to invest with fiat. But normally we had about 80% fiat investments, 20% Bitcoin investments. But we're starting to see more and more altcoin investments that we're shape-shifting into Bitcoin at the moment. And so really it's good for the whole economy, because what we're seeing is an increase in investment activity as people are becoming wealthier. They're deciding to actually shift some of that into real value. And, you know, we're working with companies that have actually got customers, that have got users, that have got profits, that have proven themselves of value at the moment and are actually using them. So overall, it's a nice ecosystem that's kind of building on each other. And now our market's worth $110 billion a market cap. That's crazy. Maybe it's going to go to a trillion. Who actually knows? But the one thing I do love about this whole market is that it was all created by us, by the free market, from scratch. Say what you want about ICOs, say what you want about alts, say what you want about Bitcoin and some of the companies. This was all created by us. And all of this wealth, this $110 billion, whether that's a bubble, whether that's fake wealth, whether it's not, whether that's more like $50 billion in reality because it's just Bitcoin, who knows? But it's all been generated by the free market, and we've had just one of the most interesting times in financial history to actually watch this whole experiment. So at Bank to the Future, we're watching the market. We're actively investing. We still are focused on companies that have actually, you know, rather than the idea funding, the later stage funding, where they've got products that are being utilized, they've got revenues, they've got profits that are being generated, or revenues that are being generated. And still the larger companies, they can't take the risk of doing these ICOs, especially if it's for their equity. So there's still a market, but the real question is equity a market that needs disrupting? And my answer is there's lots of legal protections that come with equity. Yes, there's liquidity, but you know, one of the things that we're working on is how to get liquidity into the equity market in this niche sector of fintech and blockchain. And you know, we have to go through the slow process. We're following, we've got to comply with regulations. You know, we've got to do everything in the correct compliant way. because you know that's what it just takes longer. But the market has proven that the desire for a secondary market is big. So yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of good stuff in there. I mean, it is crazy. We're over 110 billion now. And you know, I kind of tend to agree that as soon as the SEC comes in and declares Ethereum a security, it seems like a lot of that ICO value is going to come and flow back into Bitcoin.
The other thing that's worth mentioning is people think the SEC is the center of the universe, but we've been doing this for several years now. And international regulators do care. You know, they've all got rules just like the SEC. The UK has the FCA, the Hong Kong has their regulators, and international regulators, you know, we've had to comply with about 50 different financial services acts. When they care is when investors complain. And when investors complain is when they lose money. And if the Dow hadn't refunded everybody, that would have been the one. That was a very, it was kind of like they stopped with Ethereum, stopped themselves from having the regulatory challenges with the DAO at that point. But then they also created this whole Ethereum classic Ethereum, problem where people started to realize that the blockchain has a great degree of centralization.
Yep. It's true. Very interesting. I think John, had a question for you.
Yeah, I had two. One of them was actually going to ask about your opinions about the blockchain capital token, because that's a very interesting ICO where, you know, the token is actually backed by some real value, real value, not just in some speculative network that might be created, but, you know, real companies with customers and generating revenues. But I think you commented on that already. My other question was about Bank to the Future itself. What kind of companies are using the platform today, and when does it make sense to raise money through a platform like Bank to the Future instead of any of the alternatives?
Okay, so the blockchain capital was, I was really happy to see that. I was one of the pre-sale investors in that. You know, it's great to see what can happen when you combine traditional regulations with, with this alternative market. But my belief was that it missed two vital things. Firstly, it made an assumption that overseas regulators don't care, when we know they do because they contact us. We've been engaging with these regulators for many years now. And so they allowed retail investors from overseas outside of America to invest. And, what are the consequences for that? We'll see. The second challenge with it was that once they said they filed it as a security, that means it is a security. And so once it's a security, it means that in order to list that on a secondary market, it has to be listed with a securities exchange. And a securities exchange, if they charge commission on those trades, is acting as a broker dealer. And so they couldn't find an exchange that would list a security because there's no securities exchanges that are willing to list blockchain assets at the moment. I mean, that will change. But then once you do list it and comply with regulations, you can only have accredited investors, lock-in periods, US investors have certain rules, Australian investors have other rules. Some of the things that we've been grappling with for an awful long time. So the answer is, I believe that there will be two markets in the future. There'll be the regulated market, and there'll be the market just exactly like Bitcoin is right now. Bitcoin has two markets, and they're both booming at the same time. It's got the regulated market where you do your KYC, you go through an exchange, you buy your Bitcoins, and then you declare your tax. Otherwise, the tax authorities are going to subpoena the data from the exchanges and wallets and centralized wallets at some point. Or you do it the unregulated way, which is the peer-to-peer market, anonymous transactions. You don't reveal your identity. You don't do your KYC. The exact same thing will have to happen in the ICO market. If a company or someone that is identifiable says that we're going to do an ICO, they'll have to follow securities laws eventually. Or they'll try and circumvent securities law, in which case you'll have anonymous people raising funding, you know, kind of the way that Bitcoin was created. But how much trust in the model of investing in companies are there under an anonymous model? Well, I think if someone tried to create another version of Bitcoin anonymously right now, they'd have zero trust. So it's interesting to see where those two markets evolve. And yeah, you'll just have those two markets really. And that was really the problem. It's, you know, and one of the things we're working on that we've been working on for a long time is making sure that we get that license, because we are involved in, you know, we're a niche platform. You know, we're a very specific platform. We're just supporting this sector, the Bitcoin and blockchain sector. We're investing very aggressively. In the last 2 years, we've invested $170 million in rounds listed on our platform. You know, we'll go through the process of getting that license. And then eventually, once we've got the secondary market license, there will be, I guess you could call it an exchange, that will actually be able to do that and support the sector. In terms of what stage do we get involved? So I originally, when I gave my TEDx talk, I think it was in 2014, I talked about the new model of funding, which would be, you know, you have ICOs raising seed funding. Then you have online investment platforms and, you know, like Bank to the Future. And then you have other platforms like crowdfunding and that type of stuff. And I went through this model of what I thought it would look like. What I didn't forecast is that the ICO market would start raising close to IPO levels of funding, which kind of skews the market in the incentive structure in quite a bad way, like we've seen at the moment. So the type of thing that we're looking for mainly is we like for a company to have secured some kind of lead investor. They've already secured maybe some venture capital funding. Maybe they've just secured an angel investor that's gone through the due diligence process. And then we'll co-invest on the same terms and make sure investors get all the protections and rights. And we pool our investors together and get the benefit of everyone acting as one investor, but giving the companies also the benefits of having lots of investors with a private forum. So we want to see that, you know, while we do support some idea stage funding, we're looking for, you know, credible teams. We're looking for, similar things really. Some of our deals. So we did, you know, like we did Storge, we did MadeSafe that would later go on to do ICOs. And it creates a really interesting dynamic where the equity holders get, you know, millions in non-dilutive funding that goes to the balance sheet. And then you've got kind of this interesting challenge between the token holders and the equity holders. These dynamics are going to be worked out, I think, as we progress with this market. But, we take everything on a case-by-case basis. So we get a lot of applications. 5% of the applications will go to an interview. And then from there, you know, in the last 2 years, we haven't had one failed funding round. And that's because we work with a few number of companies and we work to create their best pitch. And, you know, we know what our investors like. We've got investors that have generated a lot of wealth in the crypto market that are looking to diversify some of that wealth into the companies that are growing. And we're getting, you know, some of the valuation increases that are coming as this market grows right now is incredible, because a lot of our companies have got Bitcoins and things on their balance sheet. So, the valuation increases are really kicking in now. So it's becoming a really interesting market as this whole thing has progressed. But we'll also look at some earlier stage stuff. And a lot of our other investors are just people that invest in fiat. They're interested. They've heard this market. And they like to use Bank to the Future as a way to build a very diversified portfolio, because they don't necessarily know all of the companies and what they're doing. So they invest a little bit in everything.
Yep. Very cool. Very cool. And sounds like exciting stuff over there, Simon. I tell you, if I had more money, I would love to become an accredited investor for.
Well, keep your Bitcoins and get SegWit implemented. And I'm sure everyone on this panel is going to be an accredited investor very soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People, just hold on to those Bitcoins, keep them safe in a treasure, and you should be good. I do have one last question, unless anybody else has any questions or comments on what Simon said. Nope. Okay. Just one last question, then we'll wrap it up, guys. And we've been going almost 2 hours now. So just one last question, Simon. It seems Bitcoin and cryptocurrency regulation talks are kind of happening all over the world right now, including the recent hearings in the US and Russia mandating identity checks for Bitcoin purchases and the upcoming Bitcoin exchange rules coming out of China. I just want to know from your perspective, how do you think regulation is coming and or progressing? And where do you think it's heading in the next couple of years in the short term? Like, how do you think it's progressing and where do you think we're going to end up in the short term?
I think we're going to see just the two markets. I don't think we're going to see in the short term, you know, this very progressive regulation where people, you know, I mean, you know, the Bit license was an attempt at it, but the Bit license just looked exactly like traditional regulations. So I don't think you're going to see very progressive regulations where they accept things like actually anti-money laundering works against consumer protections because you're forcing people to put their identity online. And then if you combine that with a blockchain where they can get their identity hacked, that's a ginormous consumer protection risk. The regulators aren't really considering. So I don't think they're gonna work that. I think we're just gonna have two markets. We're gonna have Bitcoin like it is in Japan, where the exchange, you know, but no one tries to regulate Bitcoin. You know, people realize that at the protocol level. But they, you know, in Japan they regulate the exchanges, and that's a very good thing for Bitcoin as well, because you know, exchanges do have very, very high levels of consumer risks of people losing all their money and practices that regulations can actually help. There's blockchain innovation that can help that, certainly. But as we saw with Bitfinex, you know, sometimes when you try and get too innovative with the blockchain and allow everyone to be able to see their balances, it creates new risks, you know, than just holding them in a cold storage wallet, you know, sometimes. So we, you know, it's kind of an interesting time like that. But in Japan, we saw, you know, that brought a ton of traditional brokers, banks that can now send Bitcoin that can integrate the API keys on top of these exchanges. You know, that's very good for the market. I mean, it's stupid. It's still, you know, it's stupid that a lot of the fund managers want to wait for an ETF till they invest in Bitcoin so they can introduce counterparty risk to a zero counterparty risk coin. But unfortunately, you know, the reality is that when you're dealing with the traditional markets and the traditional world, that's how they want to invest, and that's the only way they can invest. So, but those markets are booming, and then at the same time, you have the way that Bitcoin was originally designed and created, which is the unregulated market, and those unregulated markets are booming, just as disruptive, you know, just going to have a big, if not more, impact, where people can actually store value around the world, independent of governments, independent of central banks. Whether, you know, that market's booming as well. So you'll just have the two. Eventually you might get some kind of progressive regulations, but I believe that the unregulated Bitcoin market will eventually dwarf the traditional market, because the traditional market with all its regulations still has ginormous systemic risks that haven't been fixed since the last decade ahead. So, you know, in 2008, the Federal Reserve had about $800 billion of debt, and the financial system imploded because there was too much debt. Now the Federal Reserve has $5 trillion of debt, and the stock markets are at all-time highs, and the bond markets are at all-time highs, and everyone, you know, and property markets are still being pushed. And they found new ways of getting consumers into debt. Governments are taking on more debt. Businesses are taking on more debt. You know, and we are now still in the exact system, but a whole lot worse. Now China's got rid of their savings, and they've implemented a lot of their, you know, practices from the West, and they're building out their, you know, heavy leverage banking system, and people are, you know, taking on loans in order to invest, and a lot of the following the Western model. So we've got this, you know, these risks that are just piled up over decades. And on the side, we've got this global store of value, this exit from that, you know, called Bitcoin. And that's why no matter what happens in Ethereum, no matter what happens with these altcoins, no matter what happens with these ICOs that are all doing potentially innovative things, we've got no idea whether they're actually going to be value or not. Bitcoin has to maintain itself as a store of value, because these regulated markets are in ginormous systemic risks. And we do need an exit. We do need an opportunity for people. And, you know, it's a really strange situation that we're in as Bitcoiners right now. You know, as Bitcoiners, we've kind of seen this. And I'm really glad that the whole market, you know, anyone that's been along this market, they're now, you know, they've generated good wealth. There's $100 billion of wealth that's been created in this market. And the word is spreading and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But my fear is that at some point when more and more people own Bitcoin, we're kind of rooting for the financial system to collapse, which is not a good thing because the financial system collapsing is going to hurt a lot of people. Your mom will be hurt. Your grandma will be hurt. Your sister will be hurt. You know, a lot of people losing their pensions, their insurance policies, all that stuff is not going to be very pretty. So unfortunately, the more people you know, get Bitcoin, they're kind of rooting for this thing. But we'll see where it goes. But, you know, unfortunately, we don't need to root for it because there's ginormous systemic risk in the financial system. And thank God we've got competition in government-based currencies now. And thank God we've got this global store of value because a lot of people are going to need it. My fear is that people are going to wait until they need it to when they actually need it. But the more people that actually get on board, start experimenting with this stuff, start learning how to secure their own assets, and start learning, you know, that we've now got this system where you can earn your own money, you can spend your own money, and it's based upon a sound monetary policy. And this is why, you know, the core developers, you know, it's so important for me because the miners, we're going to need a lot of hash power in the future. We're going to need you guys, the core developers. You know, you guys have got an 8-year track record, or some of you might have come on later, but you guys have got us this far. I've got a lot of faith in what you guys are doing. You know, I wish I could understand more about what's under the hood, so I try to educate myself as much as I can. But I know you guys know and understand things, you know, just like we understand things about traditional markets. You guys understand things, and you know, I believe that this conservative approach and never breaking Bitcoin as a store of value in order for, you know, a few business people to get further forward with some impatience because they need this user case as a currency or a micropayment system. Let's just not break store of value because it's such an important thing. And whatever happens over the next and coming months, you know, this ecosystem is just incredible. It's the most exciting time to be alive in financial history. And this really, really matters. This is way more important than what it originally was back in 2011 when I gave that first, I was invited by Amir Taki to the Bitcoin conference in Prague. And, you know, I was learning from the people at the conference that what had been, what this Bitcoin thing could be. And I wasn't sure whether it could be, I'm not sure if I believed it, but today it is. And, it's such an important thing. And, So
many good points, Simon. I mean, just like, I think everybody right now should just thank Core for their conservative approach. I mean, thank you guys so much. Anybody who's worked on Core, even if you've just done a merge request, like, thank you guys so much, especially, you know, Eric, for being on the show as well. Just thank all the Core developers, because this is where we are right now. We have this global store of value and we do not want to break it. And, you know, as Simon said, there's going to be a couple markets. There's going to be, you know, the unregulated and the regulated for at least a few more years. I mean, at least until we have some more forward-thinking regulation. This is what we're going to be left with. And so, you know, you just don't have to even root for like the collapse, right? You don't have to root for the collapse. All you have to do is survive it. All Bitcoin has to do is survive these freaking banks. These banks are doing it to themselves, right? As Andreas says, all we have to do is survive the banking collapse. That's about it. So thanks so much, guys, to my panelists. Thank you guys so much. Looks like John just slipped out. Hopefully he'll be right back in. But thank you guys so much for joining us. Had a great, awesome time. Over 460 people at the height. The chat's just scrolling by a mile a minute. Thank you guys so much. Let's just say goodbye to our guests here. First, we'll say goodbye to Eric. Eric, where can we find you?
Hey, so you can find me on Twitter at Eric Lombroso, Eric_Lombroso. Then you can find me. I actually put them on the screen there. You should be able to see them. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me or to find me. I just wanted to maybe say a couple words I think that different people, you know, we're all working together to make Bitcoin great. I think we all have different roles to play. We all have different areas of expertise or specialization or different skills, and we should really put those skills to best use. We should really make the best use of the best people we have in the different things. And so I think that some people are really great at different things than I am, and I think that they should be doing that. And I think that, you know, it's just like there needs to be more mutual respect in the ecosystem as far as the really people understanding each other's value. I think that there's been too much just to focus on arguing about stuff that's silly in the end, because we all want the same thing in the end as far as Bitcoin. We want it to be a success. And so let's make that happen.
Absolutely. Awesome. I mean, great points, guys. Let's look, I mean, it's not just about the core developers, right? I mean, it's about all of us. So do what you love, but do it with Bitcoin, right? Because we all have something important to contribute. Jameson, where can we find you, sir?
Easiest to find me on Twitter. Lop is my handle, just my last name.
I knew it was Lop. Some people say it's Loop. I'm like, no, dude, it's Lop. It is straight Jameson.
It's easy to see two O's instead of two P's, but it's like I said recently, just think pistol.
Yep, and we got the three L's here, man. Light, Lombroso, and Lop. That's the three killer L's. John, where can we find you, man?
So my website is lightco.in. It's basically just a domain hack of my Twitter handle, which is Litecoin, LIGHTCOIN. Looking forward to chatting with people on the interwebs.
Awesome. Yeah, all of us here are on Twitter, and I definitely list everybody's Twitter handle in the description. So everybody here has amazing contributions on Twitter, you know, from stats to insights to everything you can think of. Everybody needs to follow everybody here on Twitter. Simon, thanks again, man, so much for joining us out of your busy schedule. I know you have being a bank to the future, I'm sure you're all over the world all the time, man. So thanks so much for joining us, and just tell us where we can find you.
You grab me on Twitter, at Simon Dixon is taken. I'm at Simon Dixon Twit.
Awesome. So thanks so much, Simon, guys. Thanks so much, everybody, for joining the show. You can, of course, find me on Twitter. I tweet about Bitcoin once in a while. you can find me at The One Vortex. So thanks, guys, so much for joining us. We'll be back again in 2 weeks with Charlie Schrem as the next special guest. And until then, guys, just keep on talking Bitcoin. See you later.